Well, hello, everyone. Thanks again for tuning in. This is another episode of the Generation Report. My name is Paul, and I have with me a guest, Sasha Stone. Welcome.
Oh, welcome. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of your work.
Oh, thanks very much, and yours. So who are you, and what should people know?
Well, the first thing you should know about me is I got online in 1994, right? Before there was even Google or Twitter or Amazon or eBay. So I know the internet really well, and I've lived probably half my life online at this point. And I used to be a very much a person who I built a website on the Oscars and on film, and I did that for 25 years. I'm still doing it. It's my main source of income. I'm proud of it. I built a business in 1999. I launched it, and a whole industry kind of bloomed around Oscar watching, right? And so there's just hundreds of Oscar sites, but back then I was the only one. So I was sort of an early internet pioneer. And I kind of, switched to politics, getting involved in the 2016 election, and then kind of becoming disillusioned with my side and my political party and the left in general as to how it's sort of eating culture alive. And so now I've been writing on Substack, which is probably more popular than the Oscar stuff at this point, but I don't know. So yeah, I mostly write about politics. And it's called, the reason that Paul has me on this podcast is because it's called Free Thinking Through the Fourth Turning, right? We're both fans of Bob Dylan and the Fourth Turning. So that's why I'm here.
Awesome. So I've been really looking forward to this conversation for a long time because I've wanted to develop some episodes that weaved in a variety of topics, especially cultural ones. So you mentioned that Awards Daily began in 1999. Do I have that date correctly?
Yeah.
What gave you the drive, the impetus to start that up?
Isn't it funny to think of it that way? Like, here I am, I've been online for over half my life at this point, but I had a baby, right? I got online in 1994. I got on a cinema group. It was Usenet. And we just dialed up and we all talked about film, all of us, for hours. It was an early form of communication. And I met a lot of people from all over the world, and I met my daughter's father in the cinema group, and he's an Italian who lives in Italy. I never would have met him otherwise. But I was raising a baby, and I wanted to work from home. And so the internet was exploding in 2000. It was like the wild, wild web, right? Anybody could build anything. They didn't think it would be profitable. People distrusted it. They didn't want to put their financials online. Everybody thought people who were online were weird. Dating especially was frowned upon. Now it's like the only way people date is online. And shop is the same. People shop online. They didn't shop back then. But all you needed was a modem and we had modems back then. I guess we still do, but I had like a dial-up modem, 12, like 28 baud modem, right? That I had to dial in on a phone line, a cable line, and a computer. And you just needed to know how to work HTML, and you needed to know the basics. You register a domain name, you get a web server, you learn HTML code, you build your main page, index.html, and you've got a page, you've got a website. And because I was writing about film and I was really into Oscar predictions, it's sort of my thing. It was my thing, right? First time was like, guys, Titanic's going to beat LA Confidential. And they're like, no way, LA Confidential is going to win because it's a much better movie. And I said, no way, Titanic is a phenomenon. It's going to win. So when it won, I caught the bug of Oscar predicting. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool to have a website that like followed the Oscar race from the beginning of the year all the way to the end and followed the ins and outs of it, and to see how it is that certain movies get nominated and certain movies win? Like, what's the process? And so that started, and it just kind of went from there, and it created this kind of sensation at the time, But of course, the first movie that won Best Picture back then was Gladiator, right? And that was, not pretty close to number one at the box office. Everybody had seen it. It was a popular movie, made a lot of money. And as you can see now, we're heading into an era where people don't even know what got nominated or what won. Nobody watches the Oscars. And so in the time that I started to now, I've watched the decline. And so anyway, the reason that I built my website was so that I could support my baby. And I thought, I'm going to make money from home, and this website's going to make it for me. And it didn't at first. It took me about 4 years or 5 years of working for free, working other odd jobs. And then finally it started to get advertising money from the studios because I just became too loud of a voice they couldn't ignore. And so they started advertising, and that's how I've sort of made my money all this time.
Cool. I've just within the last 6 months or so begun to really take an interest in what a lot of the early pioneers on the internet, and it certainly sounds like you are one. I don't know if you would call yourself one, but that timeline kind of places you there. Were there people who are known names or commodities today who were kind of in your circle starting in this space back then?
Well, what I noticed was the next generation coming behind me, the millennials, because I'm Gen X, the millennials were sharper, smarter, faster. And when they took to the internet, they built huge dot coms. And the big deal back then was going public. I always kind of pretended I was sort of this early pioneer, this web person. And it was fine for what it was. You know, it was kind of like a thrift store, basically. But these guys came along, the Zuckerbergs and the early pioneers, and they built an internet that I couldn't have fathomed. And so they were always way ahead of me. I don't remember anyone other than the people in my field who, well, Craigslist, he was online. He was an early guy. So we were around the same time. That's something I can remember, like an early sort of raw, plain website that was starting that people were using. But for the most part, I mean, it was so fun, I have to say, back then, because before social media came along, before opinion-based journalism took over regular journalism, it was a really exciting time because people weren't tracking you. They weren't monitoring what you thought. You couldn't get in trouble. You couldn't get banned or blocked. And so there was a freedom to it that we don't have anymore that was thrilling to be a part of. And now it just feels so different, really. Almost feels like poison when you spend time online, but it didn't back then. It was delightful. You're meeting people from all over the world. Like, when else in human history have we had that many people online and that many people alive and that many people connected at once? So I knew it was going to cause trouble to the human brain at some point. I wouldn't figure that out till much later, till after the social media and the smartphone came. But you think about these technological achievements in history, like the printing press or the radio or television, and how it changed society, in shocking ways. In a lot of, like, you could almost say that Hitler and the Holocaust happened because of the invention of the radio, and you could say that the Salem witch trials because of the invention of the printing press, maybe McCarthyism because of the invention of the television. And certainly what we're living through now is directly related to the invention of the internet.
Yeah, the relationship between the news and our perception of it's something that's just, I think it's baked in. And the perception of the situation in the country today, I think more and more people are waking up to what's really happening and what the stakes are, which is why the fourth turning is becoming more and more of an item that people are searching for. It's a book that people are buying in big volume again. More and more content's being made about it or around it. And one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you was because you're one of the few people who I've seen and come across who is willing to move that conversation in a new direction and not just stay with it as initially carved out 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah, so you're pretty aware of how different the first book by Neil Howe and William Strauss in 1997 was written versus now the update by just Neil Howe without William Strauss. What do you think is the biggest change there, in the way that he wrote that? Because I've looked at the two in comparison, and I mainly look at how he describes the fourth turning, the Great War paragraph. There will be a great, we will pass through the great gate of history. That whole part. Like, so I looked at the two different ways that he changed that. That was the most fascinating part to me. The rest of it, I don't know that he really changed all that much.
Yeah, I would say that the biggest difference, if there is one, it's that they were willing, at least this is my perception, to talk about the cycle and to talk about what it meant for America's future as a process of change. This is a process of change that happens, and people need to be ready for what's coming based upon how our study of the past and our study of generations seems to forecast certain things in the future. In this new book, I felt that Neil, rather than focusing on the cycle as a process of change, he was focusing on the cycle as something that was self-contained and very deterministic over what happens. And that basically confirmed suspicions that I had had going back to at least 2021, that while he's gotten an awful lot right about the state that we find ourselves in today, and he deserves lasting credit for that, as does Bill Strauss, the conversation needs to move, and it can't just rely on one voice anymore. You could read through the lines and tell that he was being very insistent that things are going to happen based upon the theory and the ideas that we originally conceived of in the 1990s, and that and is a reason why I now consider myself as having departed from his view on things.
Interesting. Well, I hope you consider writing a book, because there aren't that many people. There's this one book that I found. I don't know if you know about this. It's called Pendulum: How Generations of the Past Shape Our Present. And I always forget the title. Shape Our Present and Predict Our Future. And it's a book by two guys. And it's a mess. I mean, I've never seen. I'm sorry to have to say this, but it's a great idea. But I've never seen a worse written like presentation of an idea. But it's brilliant. I just wish that it wasn't so, because when I recommend it to people, they look at it and what is this? And the audiobook isn't much better. It's just as chaotic. And if you watch videos of the guy, I'll think of his name in a minute, but when you watch videos of him on YouTube, and there aren't that many of them, I'll send you one later. He's this like hippie dude, right? But whatever they stumbled upon, it was brilliant, because they took Neil Howe's and Strauss's 80-year cycle, right? Because so they say, you know, the basic human lifespan is about 80 years, and you can divide that up into the seasons, you know, spring, summer, winter, fall, and we're in winter right now, which is the fourth turning, where everything has to die off, and then for make way for new growth, and everything is done by the generations. So we're coming to the end of the baby boomer generation now, and the millennials are about to take over as the lead, which is obvious. I mean, it should be obvious to everyone that the millennials have totally taken over, because they have. And I like that idea of the patterns of the generations. I like the coddled baby boomers, children, then launch the counterculture, and then they become the boomers, and then now they're on the way out. It's just all very fascinating to me to look at things in patterns. So these guys took the 80-year cycle and they chopped it into two 40-year cycles. And then one is called the me cycle, which is individualism. And the other is the we cycle, which is collectivism. And then they divided up each of those 40-year cycles into two, where you have the upswing of the me cycle and then the downswing. So they say that their theory is humans always take a good thing too far. And so when individualism is taken too far, it becomes narcissism and nihilism and despair. And then we spend 20 years spiraling from that, and then we head toward collectivism. And when they wrote this book, it was heading into Obama's second term. So it was like 2011 or something. And they predicted that when collectivism goes wrong, it hits what they call the witch hunt phase, where all of a sudden everybody, this collectivist utopia that they built, people start turning on each other. And that once that happens, it spirals down again and eventually heads back toward individualism. But this happens slowly. It's like 80 years, but 40 years of each. So, and I've built charts on this to try to see where we are right now. But man, these guys predicted 2023 to be the witch hunt. How the hell did they do that all the way back? And I mean, that is just, to me, astonishing. And I still am impressed by them that they managed to figure this out, because it does make sense to me more than Neil Howe's theory, because it does show why people move away from certain movements and why those movements become stale over time. You know, and they do it all through the same thing that the fourth turning does. They do the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, the Salem witch trials, and all that. And so they both, Neil Howe and these guys, all say that we're not even through the worst of it yet. Yay.
Yeah. An inspiring thought. It's interesting you mentioned the upswing idea. There is a book that came out, I believe, shortly before the 2020 election. It was called The Upswing by Dr. Robert Putnam and a woman whose last name is Romney. I can never remember her first name. That was a similar idea, me versus we,
Oh.
except it was not quite in the along the 40-year timeline. And there was essentially no downside to the we. For those who don't know, Robert Putnam is one of the most famous social scientists in America. He wrote a very famous book in the late 1990s that came out in 2000 called Bowling Alone. But in this particular book, he and his co-author essentially say what America needs is more democracy in the way the word democracy has taken on a different meaning than it used to. America needs more democracy on every front and more rule by experts. So you
Oh,
can
great.
imagine
Sounds
so you
wonderful.
can imagine some of the specific conclusions that they came to there. But yeah.
I found that Neil Howe's latest book felt to me like he was heading a little in that direction, I thought, with his idea of like, and when it's all settled, we'll have this beautiful collectivist utopia is
Yes.
sort of what I thought he was saying. And I was like, no. So these other guys were the only ones I've seen that talk about the downside of collectivism. You know, the when it turns into the look, there's no denying the witch hunt phase. It exists. Look at what happened, you know. So and it's just a matter of where it goes and how far the backlash. But the problem is the newsmakers, the media, as you cover a lot in your series, they're so influential. They're so, you know, it's so easy to spread. And they are the ones that say, oh, everybody's spreading disinformation and misinformation, but they spread it too. It's really hard to fight against that and remain, you know, independent minded. It's almost impossible, really, for young people especially.
Yeah, if I'm glad you mentioned the influence of the media and sort of the people in the punditry and intellectual spaces. If I may be permitted to do a shameless plug of one of my prior episodes.
Please.
So in 2022, I became aware that there were a lot of intellectuals associated with university faculties who were making regular appearances on cable news, especially MSNBC, to a degree
Yeah.
that far exceeded what I remembered before the 2020 election and even in the 2020 election's crazy aftermath. And I wanted to produce something that shone a light on what a few of these people were saying and how there was clearly a connection. There was clearly a channel, or at least an echo chamber, between what this elite group of intellectuals were saying and how that was being picked up by the powers that be.
Yeah.
And I profiled six different people in this episode. It's called A Nation of Intellectuals.
Love it.
And for those who may be wondering whether I read all of the books that I profiled in that episode, the answer is yes. It took me a long time to
Wow.
prepare and contour arguments. When you read those books, you see very clearly how their arguments are moving up the chain to the people who are trying to control the narrative.
And they're leaving out the cries of the working class. Like they don't even care at this point. But I know you don't want to make this too political, so we won't go into the politics too much.
Oh, that's
But
fine. What's interesting is it's hard for me to say that I had a definite political view of things when I was 14, 15, 16. For what it's worth, I was in high school on 9/11. And I initially supported the invasion of Iraq for a number of reasons. I believed what was being said at the time. I also felt that there were just certain steps that needed to be taken to prevent 9/11 from happening again. My mother, for what it's worth, was in New York on 9/11. And then it became pretty clear by the time my senior in high year in high school was getting underway that we were making a lot of mistakes, or our leaders were making a lot of mistakes in their execution of the Iraq policy, the Iraq war. And I could see as that awareness was being picked up by the general public that the powers that be in the popular culture especially took full advantage of those missteps to swing the narrative completely to their side. And I believe that that's what made John Stewart the person he is today. John Stewart is not the person he ultimately became
No.
without the prevailing winds after the mistakes that were made in Iraq in 2003, I would claim.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I what I remember about that era is two things. I remember how terrified we all were. My daughter was 3 when the buildings were hit. I remember how terrified we all were, and I remember how most people were for the war. They weren't against the war because we were so scared at that point. There were orange alerts, terror level. It was a surveillance. Our country became a surveillance state almost overnight, and we were fine with that because we were terrified. And then I did watch those people, the people that eventually, let's call them they, right? Now, I'm writing something right now about they. And I think these people are very smart, like Ron Klain, people who work with Obama, right? The people who helped make Obama, that coalition of really bright young activists who did exactly what you're saying, is they shifted the narrative from whatever it was that Saddam Hussein threatened, which is basically Vladimir Putin right now, I think is where Saddam Hussein was back then. And they turned it into, there were no weapons of mass destruction. These guys are liars. And it then became a way to take the GOP completely out of power, to destroy them and to rebuild this new left utopia. But in the middle of that, the iPhone, social media, this is like happening all at the same time. And the Wall Street crash of 2008, the crisis that sparks the fourth turning. It's all happening right at the same time. Fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I wonder if most people have a vivid recollection of some of the little things that we take for granted now, like you just mentioned the introduction of the iPhone. I remember very distinctly where I was when the iPhone first hit stores. I was at a wedding that weekend. It was either late June or early July of 2007. We were eating at a restaurant in Maryland, and the line for the Apple store across the street was around the block and like two blocks in the other direction. It was nuts. And we can't even imagine the world without the iPhone now, but back then it caused a lot of crazy. And I actually graduated from college in 2008, which I've started to be more upfront about that on the podcast, that really ignited my not just fascination, but obsession with these ideas and with these subjects, because my relationship with the turn the economy took and everything that changed within a very short period of time after the global financial crisis really hit is it is super personal. That was a very tough time in my life. And when I first came across Strauss and Howe's work, it was like, oh, that's what happened to me. That makes a lot of sense. And I was still a little bit skeptical, but I definitely did, as many people do, connected to all kinds of personal moments and anecdotes from my life and observations about my generation that I felt they were, if not 100% right about, pretty close to the mark about. And I just said, that's it. I want to know more. So there was that whole period from the middle of the 2000s through when the global financial crisis started to die down, or at least began to give way to the post-global financial crisis malaise, was kind of the time that planted the seeds for my fascination with this stuff.
Oh, that's amazing. I didn't get to it till much later, as you say, because I never even heard of it until Donald Trump won the election. And I heard about Steve Bannon. I had no idea what the fourth turning was until that point. And then when who's this guy? Who's Steve Bannon? And so I did a deep dive on him, and I started to find out everything I could of Steve Bannon. We should say, thanks to the witch hunt phase, is now serving time for contempt of Congress for 4 months, but which is horrifying in my opinion. And then I thought, okay, the fourth turning. He made this movie about the fourth turning. That's interesting. And so people like me, I'm like the base of the Democratic Party, unmarried, white women, right? Social justice oriented white women, or that's what I was. thought that the fourth turning was this apocalyptic, like the way they're talking about Project 25 right now is how they're talking about the fourth turning back then. And so I thought, oh, this document. But I had no idea that like Neil Howe is like a, you know, he's a liberal and it's very tame and it's not apocalyptic at all. It's just that Steve Bannon happened to see the patterns already. He could see. So what he did was he tried to wrestle the narrative and manipulate it himself. Like he said, okay, there's Occupy Wall Street. That's the people rising up against the government. So we're going to build this over here on the right, the Tea Party. We're going to have our own populist movement. And over time, populism died on the left after Bernie's campaign crash and burn, and it was only left to the Trump side to continue the populist uprising per the fourth turning, which I find fascinating. So Steve Bannon knows that, and he continues to guide the MAGA movement in that direction, hoping that he's going to somehow have a seat in changing the future and making history go the way that he wants it to go, which is nationalist populism, for whatever, however they define that.
Yeah, I definitely have mixed feelings about Steve Bannon. He's obviously incredibly bright.
Yeah.
He does get over his skis on a lot. As far as the prosecution or persecution of him, I just can't say I'm surprised given the way things
Yeah.
are, where things have gone. He's just one of those people that they've had in their sights for quite some time. What's so interesting about him is that he was not the first prominent person to latch on to Strauss and Howe's ideas and to embrace them and embrace them publicly. The first was Al Gore.
I didn't know that.
That's right. Al Gore, I can't remember if he was part of the same class at Harvard as Bill Strauss, but they knew each other. And he was so enthusiastic when he picked up a copy of Generations, Strauss and Howe's first book, which came out in 1991. He was so enthusiastic about it after reading it that he sent a copy of it to every other member of Congress, which
Wow.
534 copies, which is, I can't even imagine the
Did he
shipping
know he was
costs.
a did he know he was a boomer in that when
Oh
he
yeah.
read
Oh, I'm sure
that?
he did. Yeah, and he's boomer to the nth
He's
power.
like
He's
you, a millennial reading about it, and you're a millennial.
One of those people when you read Strauss and Howe's descriptions of the boomers as a generation, I think Al Gore is in a select group with people like the Clintons,
Yeah.
like Trump, like I would even add Bill Maher to that mix. At least for me, jumps to mind right away as, oh, this guy's boomer to the nth power. But he was the first person who became known as a fan of their work in the face of what was a lot of skepticism from academics, pundits, other intellectuals, and the mainstream media. They did not embrace Strauss and Howe so easily. But what's interesting is they embraced Strauss and Howe more in the early 90s when their work was new and when the boomers were taking power. You can actually go on YouTube and perhaps even some other corners of the internet where you can find that when Bill Clinton was becoming president, they were calling his ascent to being president a kind of generational changing of the guard. And it was heavily laden with Strauss Howe references and Strauss Howe language concepts, the whole thing. But the fourth turning raised the stakes. And because there are lines in that book and there are ideas in that book that the powers that be post 2000 did not want to wind up in the wrong hands,
Yeah.
Steve Bannon has become the person who is attached to their names. And Neil Howe, I'm sure, has taken an enormous amount of flack for Steve Bannon being the person who is most closely associated with
Yeah, no
his
doubt
book.
about it. I was you know, because I was part of the left, the bubble of the left for so long, that I knew that even mentioning the fourth turning was considered, it was contraband. And that's why it was so funny when I finally, that was just part of one of the things that sort of punctured the hysteria of what it's like to be on the left, to be, you know, in this fear bunker all the time, so worried about the other half of the country. And even Steve Bannon, he was thought of as, you know, the dark overlord. But The thing about Steve Bannon that I've learned, because I've listened to The War Room quite a bit, because I wanted to find out what the deal is with him, and he's hyperbolic like Trump, and they both just sort of say stuff. And we live in a time where you can't just say stuff. You can't, because if you say stuff, you're outing yourself as a racist, a fascist, a homophobe, you know. And so you have to watch every word. I have to watch what I say, even with my closest friends now. My best friends, people I've known all my life, I have to be careful that I don't use the wrong word. And I just find that really strange. And so Steve Bannon, like Trump, they both love to just troll. And so they love to say stuff that they know is going to get people. Steve Bannon loves when he's criticized. He plays it on his show all the time. People are calling him whatever they are, whatever he's mentioned in New York Times or anywhere else. He plays it and he showcases it because he's proud that he's made that kind of impact, you know. I find him a very fascinating figure, especially vis-a-vis the fourth turning, what we're all talking about here. But you know what they didn't plan on? They didn't plan on Bill Clinton getting impeached in 1999. Right before 9/11. Like, to me, those two events together was such a big moment in our history that not enough people talk about, because it was the weakening of leadership at the top, I think, that helped lead to that attack, which is kind of what I see with Biden now. The weakening of leadership is causing these other wars as we head toward our great war and our great gate of history. Fingers crossed that it all goes well.
Yeah,
It's
fingers
not
crossed.
nuclear annihilation.
Fingers crossed very tightly. So that actually struck me. I want to encourage everyone listening to check out Sasha's Substack. It's called Rethinking Through the Fourth Turning. I've, over the last week or so, been combing through a lot of the essays that you've written there, as well as the audio releases that have come out on YouTube. I know you're on iTunes also. One piece that I know you were working on for quite some time, because we chatted before, was Hollywood can't save itself, let alone Joe Biden. A lot to unpack from the title and from a lot of the things that you talked about in that essay. Do you want to just go into how you see the state of Hollywood and the popular culture and how they're getting
Sure.
behind one side?
Yeah, and but I'd also like to say, for my listeners who might be listening, you've got to check out all the videos that Paul has made. You'll love them. And look at the one about Joe Biden being the great. We haven't even gone into the great champion yet, but he has a great one about that. And I've sort of poured through them. They're much more concise than mine, and they're much more neatly organized. You can listen to them all quickly, and I would highly recommend that. Subscribe as well. Although he should be moving to Substack, so maybe that'll be happening soon. Yeah. So the same problem we're having in politics, we have in Hollywood, which is the boomers won't get out the way. Right? I know Joe Biden's not a boomer; he's silent, but still, the boomer class, man, they are. Their foot, like Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, these guys are like, and you did a whole thing about who is the great champion, and you went through all the different people who were and why they do and why they don't fit. But that's the ha problem in Hollywood too, because you have the Steven Spielbergs, the Francis Ford Coppolas, and they are so intertwined with politics, with the Democratic Party, that they've become the same organism. And so, as the Democratic Party, in my opinion, starts to collapse, which I do believe that it is in a state of collapse, they're sort of dragging Hollywood down with them. So, over the past, well, speaking, since you're interested in patterns of history, I'll tell you my theory, which is that, you know, the internet really did change everything. But right around 2000, because I know I'd been covering the Oscars for that long, we had Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings came out. And they showed Hollywood that they could make ungodly sums of money with these big franchises, as long as they were, you know, serials that they could release one after the other, and particularly making money in China and in North in South not North Korea, in South Korea. And if you look at the box, if you go to Box Office Mojo and you do an all-time search, or you do annual and you look at the money Hollywood made starting in 2000, and then go all the way up to now, and look at the trajectory of the box office. And you'll see that in the phase between 2003 and 2020, when COVID hit and kind of brought everything to its knees in Hollywood, they were making like 11 billion, 12 billion a year, an insane amount of money. And they were doing it with these IPs, Marvel mostly, Star Wars, animated films. But what they had done was they built a fast food model for film. Meant like when you're driving on the highway and you see Burger King, McDonald's, Paquito Moss, whatever it is, Starbucks. So what they did was they figured out if it's a lot of people involved, choice overwhelms them and depresses them. So you need fewer choices, but you also need expectations met. So like I went to Portland, a couple of years ago, and I noticed that they have all those amazing coffee shops, yet the most crowded one was Starbucks. Like, why is Starbucks when you have all these beautiful, because people don't want to take a chance with a mom and pop when they can have something that they know exactly what they're going to get for their money. So they did the same thing with movies. They reduce them down and serve them to the masses, giving them fewer choices, expectations met. And it made them the same kind of money as it makes fast food until COVID and the Great Awakening. Those two things hit Hollywood hard. But meanwhile, on my business, the Oscar race had become like the Bates Motel. Have you ever seen Psycho, Alfred
Yes.
Hitchcock? Okay. Do you know how Bates Motel is off the side of the road, it's his own little hotel, and nobody goes on the interstate anymore? So that's what the Oscar race became. It's just this own little world that had nothing to do with the business of Hollywood, because these movies were not making any money anymore, and they didn't need to make money. A director friend of mine once said that the Oscars are like the salad at McDonald's, right? It's like we're selling salad. Nobody's really going to eat the salad, but it sort of shows that we're health conscious. So if we have these quality stamps, we can sell our fast food over here, and we can still have our sophisticated fare over here, our hothouse flowers designed for the Oscars. So they fractured these two over time. And they speciated. They became completely different species, right? And then the Great Awakening hit at the same time as COVID in 2020. Everything collapsed. Everything. The Oscar race, big budget, everything collapsed. And at the same time, China had decided that they didn't want to make Hollywood rich anymore. They wanted to make their own films. And shockingly, they have an incredibly profitable, or they did before COVID, film industry that actually competes with ours in a way that should have scared Hollywood, because they said, we don't really like your movies. They're weird, and we'd rather make our own and make our money for ourselves. And their movies are pure Chinese propaganda, but they make so much money, enough to compete with American products. So that part got cut off. So that hurt Hollywood a lot. Just that one thing of China saying, we're not going to accept every single movie that you want. We're going to make sure it's aligns with our beliefs, and we're not just going to take anything because you're bringing bad influence over here. So that hurt them right off. But then there was a revolution in Hollywood. The Great Awakening hit it so hard that when we came out of it, every movie was suddenly woke. Every movie, every ad on television, every Lifetime show, every sitcom, every fitness app, every app, everywhere, every billboard, everywhere you looked, they had to reflect this. I guess it's the streets of Manhattan view of America. Like when you walk through Manhattan and you see this wonderful diversity all around you, this cosmopolitan look of people of every kind of, race and gender. But that's not what America looks like. You know what I mean? So you can't just sell everything as this homogenous view of like peanut M&Ms, one of every kind. But that's what they had to do because they were mandated to do it. And so it destroyed their brand. It destroyed their fast food because it's like they're saying, come to McDonald's, but we're not going to give you French fries anymore. We're swapping it out for raw broccoli because raw broccoli is better for you and it's better for the planet. And you can't look at us and say, we're making everybody unhealthy. So you're going to eat that. But of course, no one's going to eat it. No one's going to buy it. No one's going to want it. Right. And so people stopped showing up. And it died. The box office died. If you go now, you'll see two movies that are doing well, which is Despicable Me 4 and Inside Out 2, which is like family movies. But everything else, they bombed one after the other. The Fall Guy bombed. Furiosa bombed. They lost to their audience, and the audience is not coming back. And the same thing happened with the Oscars. The Oscars became something that people looked at and said, people aren't really winning these. This is just a utopian diorama, and we're moving around the pieces and we're pretending like we're changing the world. First female filmmaker wins. First film by a Black director wins. First film with an all-Asian cast. First film with an all-deaf cast. And by last year, finally, with Oppenheimer and Barbie, it felt like things were shifting, you know, because these two movies created a sensation online, Barbenheimer. So all these people were showing up, and we were all like, great, this is fantastic. Everything's going to be back to normal. And then the actors and the writers went on strike, and it brought everything back down to their knees. And now they're still trying to dig their way out of it. And through all of this, of course, I'm not neglecting the streaming pressure, the pressure from streaming, but I personally don't think that's the main reason, though most people want to believe that it is. I think if there are movies that are exciting enough for people to see, they'll go out to see them. Like the upcoming movie Twisters, I think a lot of people are going to go see that. And the Formula One movie with Brad Pitt next year, that looks good. And Joker, they'll go see. You know, there's a handful of them that they can still sell, but overall, they wrecked their brand with good intentions. You can't separate them from the Democratic Party anymore because they're a one and the same. So that's what I meant by that.
That's great. Now, I'm so fascinated by the move that the whole culture took towards this woke sensibility. In the years, I think Occupy Wall Street was probably the very beginning of it.
Yeah.
But between Occupy Wall Street, which I guess was mid to late 2011, and the election of Donald Trump,
Right.
it was actually probably a more concise timeline than that. But the years in between, for sure. What's so fascinating about that whole timeline for me is that in late 2012, I was finishing my education and went through a kind of a nomadic phase after that, looking for work with my fancy degree that I thought was going to get me a leg up in the world, but instead it didn't turn out that way. And I wound my way almost to the other side of the country from where I live now to a job that was essentially a one-stop information hub. Every political race, essentially around the country of consequence, was being tracked by this organization that I went to work for a little while. And it was run by a former politician. And this person, who will remain nameless for now, who ran this organization, which will also remain nameless for now, it was a beehive of dysfunction run by somebody who was an incompetent jerk.
Are we talking Texas?
Not Texas, but another state west of the Mississippi, and it's one of the larger ones.
Oh, okay. Because I was thinking Beto O'Rourke.
This particular person, not to drag boomers through the mud, my parents' generation boomers, but this particular person was a boomer who had been a politician of some name recognition many years ago now. And
Yeah.
he was my boss. And if you didn't meet him in person, you would never believe that he was real. But he
Oh.
was. And I mentioned before that the response to the Iraq War was kind of the first moment in my life when my view of things began to shift. This was the second moment for me. And as it so happened, when I left that job and came back to basically the area where I live now, it wasn't more than a week before the Ferguson verdict came in and the riots happened and the media
Oh.
went crazy the way I'm sure you remember. And this was also, as it so happened, right in the wake of when I read The Fourth Turning for the first time. It
Oh.
was a whole lot of currents just
Wow.
coming together at the same time. And I remember making a mental note to myself, I want to see where this goes. I can't believe I'm actually laughing saying it, but it was one of
No, but
those.
it's so fascinating because I said to my friend the other day, he was like, "When do you think all this woke crap started?" And he said, and I said, "When do you think?" And he said, "With Trump." And I said, "It didn't start with Trump. No. It started way before that." Because And I actually got this. I'm going to steal from Ben Shapiro, who's very smart. He said it in 2012, after Obama's second term win, which is to me when I noticed that the internet, that my group on Twitter was driving the media narrative, and we were able to create a media narrative and basically lie about Mitt Romney, which turned out to be really easy to do. We could make the reality we wanted, and it was quite a feeling of having a lot of power. That we noticed in the 20 that I noticed in the 2012 election, and not at the time, but looking back, I see what that was. But it was right at that time that the Tea Party was starting to rise. if you look at the Tea Party, which again, I have to be very clear, is that I was a person on the left. I was a devoted Democrat. I was woke. I was a woke blogger. All I did was write about race and gender on the Oscars for years. And I was really awful about it and shrill and, you know, terrible. And I wish I could take those years back because I never thought it would come to where it is now, that I would help destroy it, but I did. So I can't lie about that. I can't sit here and say I was it's like you with the Iraq War. Like I can't pretend that I didn't help build all this and that I wasn't a part of it. I was very much a part of it. I was right there. I didn't notice this until later, looking back, because I too thought the Tea Party was racist. And I didn't realize that it was the fear of racism in the rise of the Tea Party and Donald Trump that caused the beginnings of the woke revolution and the hysteria that came in the wake of it. The mass hysteria, I believe. It's like communism. Racism was the new communism. But I had sent my daughter to all the public schools in Los Angeles area, and her high school was right around 2013. They were teaching critical race theory. And I didn't know, I thought it sounded like a cult. I would tell her, guy, this is like a cult, isn't it? And my nephew called it a social justice military academy. And it was a public school. And she was learning, she was told as a white person that she had white privilege and she had to stand up. This is my daughter grew up in, Obama was the first president she knew. Her best friend had was black. Throughout her whole life, racism wasn't something that she had even been in her head. Yet she was told she was white. And in high school, when you're trying to find your own identity and you're nervous and self-conscious anyway, all the white people had to stand outside the circle, and only the people of color were ever allowed to talk. And it started, they started to build this little, her generation, Gen Z, to build this little hierarchy. If you're white and you're male, you're at the bottom. If you're white and you're female, you're at the bottom, maybe just a tiny bit up if you're a good ally. White men, you have to be completely subservient to the entire cause or you're out. But then it just went up to the most marginalized, the most oppressed, the wheel of oppression, you know. If you're a person of color, you're automatically oppressed. If you can negotiate as a white person, if you're gay or if you're queer, if you're bi, you could buy, please give me a break. Everybody's buy. No, but I'm just kidding. But you know what I mean? Like that's going to give you status. And then transgender people seem to be at the very top of the list. But they've even worked in like overweight people now. And like that's a thing that has to be represented. And it's, you know, it's so strange that this has become our new normal. Well, because my daughter's generation, they all came of age and they all got jobs and they all started to push the narrative. And that's where it ended up. And they made demands and they're scolds, you know, they're tyrants, little baby tyrants. And then the institutions listen to them. And it's exactly what you said, the Occupy Wall Street, because as Vivek Ramaswamy always points out, that was the moment that they said, we can't address these problems of a $700 billion bailout and people who are saying, how could you do that to us? So they had to shift it to identity. Because it got them off the hook, right? Because now they could make it all about race and gender and wokeness, and it didn't have to anymore be about class. So that's really what started was a way out for them, but it's also how they absolve themselves of their sins of privilege. Like they can demonize half the country because they believe that they're of the virtuous. You know, they can say, like Minnie Driver. That actress who just said that like 70 million people in America are racist because they Trump is their representative. She can say that because she is of the class of people, the elect, the people who believe that all they have to do is if they obey the hierarchy, then they're off the hook. She'll never be seen as an aristocrat, right?
Right. I'm laughing for two reasons. One, because she's in Good Will Hunting, which is one of my absolute favorite movies. Two,
Oh.
because she's British,
All right.
which, you know, obviously this woke thing has a worldwide or at least an
Yes.
international dimension to it. It's funny that she called Americans racist. The
I know,
British
and
actress. It's like, okay. Yeah.
she's such a mean person. I was at this party at Pierce Brosnan's house of all, like there were we were celebrating Rory Kennedy's documentary at the time, and there was a very small gathering of us, and she was there. And I mean, we're talking like 10, 12 people, like really small. So it wasn't like I was some fan. But like we kind of were in the same area, and I looked at her and I smiled, as how you do when you make eye contact with someone. And she just stared at me, looked me up and down, and just walked away. Like I just thought, oh. And so I've never liked her ever since then, because it's just such a cold thing to do. She didn't know me, so she didn't want to smile or even say hi. And I realize that's an American thing, and that a lot of people in other countries don't really do that. So I have to sort of maybe give her a break for that reason, but I thought it was very rude personally.
Yeah, three things came to mind as you were relaying that story. One is near the end of my time in graduate school, I noticed that the safe space phenomenon was starting to become a big thing. I never thought of it in terms of this is going to create a movement of mass hysteria on campuses in a few years, but I thought of it basically. The basic way it would present itself is that you would be walking through the faculty and administrative staff corridors of the building where I was taking my classes, and the stickers would be on the door, "This office is a safe space." And there was a little rainbow over the top of it, and the implications were kind of clear from there. But I always thought of it as a simple statement of if you need to unburden yourself for any reason in this kind of pressure cooker environment of everybody feeling like they have to get perfect grades to stand out and to land a good job in the real world when you leave this place. If anything is personally bringing you down while you're here and it just comes out in this office, don't worry, you won't be judged, at least not too harshly. I thought it was as simple and as benign as that. And within a few years, by the time I was either approaching or just past age 30, and I saw what the safe space phenomenon had become, I was like, oh my God.
You just made me think of something that would be really funny in a sci-fi novel. Is like, what if you had like, you know how they have like smoking areas in airports? What if they had like safe spaces, like real safe spaces? You could walk in, and you could just have a normal conversation,
Yeah,
and no
yeah.
one's listening, and then you go back out, and you're like, okay, yes, we're all buttoned up now. We're all going to be very good. But you know what Neil Howe didn't do, and William Strauss is, and this is something that I look at, but I do so with the lens of the collectivism, individualism. You know, it's so easy to see like Reagan individualism 80s and then collectivism 2000s with Obama. And in between that was the 90s, was Bill Clinton. And what happened then, which is so interesting if you think of pendulum theory, because the individualism left people hollowed out. Like I've seen it in my lifetime because I'm so old that like I was a kid in the 70s. So I know what it was like when all the hippies, the boomers, had left their greatest generation parents and left specifically religion, Christianity, Judaism, religion. That's what they were breaking free from when they built their counterculture, right? So in the 1960s, it was like, get me away from this, get me away from structure, get me away from belief in God as my center, right? And what they did then was that they went searching for other ways to fill that void. So it was concerts, and it was political activism, and it was investigative journalism, and it was politics, and ultimately by the 90s, by all that time after Reagan, you know, after the loss of Jimmy Carter and the end of the counterculture movement, if you watch The Big Chill, it's about how the boomers went from the counterculture 60s to like the yuppies in the
Oh, yeah.
80s, where they all wanted mortgages. And this is a great movie for
Oh, yeah.
that. It's a total fourth turning movie, is The Big Chill. And so then you get to the 90s. And it's despair and it's emptiness and there's nothing because you've gone through everything. You've gone through all the counterculture, then you've gone through the yuppies, the greed is good era of the 80s. And here you are. And so what happened in the 90s? Big Pharma made it legal to advertise to consumers. This is what RFK is talking about. For the first time, they could sell psych meds. You know, it could be sold on TV. And so the 90s was when everybody started to get medicated. I don't know if you remember that, but it was the self-help revolution. It was Oprah every day at 3. It was everybody has trauma. Everybody is abused. Your parents abused you. You had a bad childhood. You're in an abusive relationship. And we developed this language around self-help. People like me, I'm ground zero for all this because I'm a helicopter parent on top of everything else. So I learned the language of, you know, and no man is ever good enough because Men have to meet all of these different things. They have to be good listeners. They have to be great in bed. They have to be providers. They have to be politically correct, good fathers. They can never say a bad word. They can never insult you, you know? And so we put in all these standards for our relationships. And in women like me, we just chased the dragon. And I know that's the case with many women in my generation. But the safe space thing came from parents like me raising kids. You escaped this because you're a millennial, but my generation that had kids in the 90s, we overprotected our children. My poor daughter just learned to drive and she's like 26 now. It's just, and that's how much I overprotected her. And like we kept them inside and we, you know, we were afraid of everything and we didn't let them have parties. They couldn't play outside. And so they just disappeared into the internet and they created this madness, but with this blanket of trauma over them. Like, I am traumatized. I have anxiety. I have problems. And that's the generation we created. And so that does go back to the fourth turning in terms of how generations create different effects that each generation. So I'm hoping that after Gen Z, the next generation might be free of some of that, you know, that crazy oppression.
Yeah, the having the reference point of being an older millennial is really interesting for a lot of reasons. I spent a lot of time after school, especially, and at family gatherings around Xers growing up. And I knew certainly by the time I was 7 or 8 years old that I was different from them and they were different from me, like intrinsically. The example, and I can't believe I just had a bolt of lightning of the mind within the last maybe 6 months, that the person who I was probably the most like when I was 7, 8, 9 years old. Have you ever seen Jurassic Park?
Course.
Remember Timmy?
Yes.
That's the way I was at that age. And
Oh,
what's so fascinating
how
is I found
cute.
out that the actor, whose name is, I think, Joe Mazzello, he was born in 1983, 2 years before me. That was not the first example that hammered home for me. The boundaries that Strauss and Howe drew between Xers and millennials belong in a certain place. And, you know, these differences are not socially constructed, they're real. That was actually a pretty quick intuitive pickup that I made once I got into their work 10 years ago. But over time, I've become more and more aware that that leap from even people born in the late 70s, very early 80s to people around my age was immense. And there's so much conversation now about, again, how hyperprotective parents became, especially, I think, near the end of the 90s and through the 2000s. That all started with people around my age. And while the habits and the behaviors picked up from overprotection are more pronounced among people about 10, 15 years younger than me, that's a reflection of them just being a little bit younger. I look upon people my own age and I say, you know, we escaped some of the things that are being painted on people younger than us, but we didn't escape it totally. And we have a lot of the same personality characteristics. One of my big ambitions is to write what I hope will be the definitive piece of work and produce an episode on the hero archetype, because this is
Nice.
where I think my experience being an older millennial who graduated from college when the world fell apart and has spent the last few years, especially spending more time than I ever did in high school, college, or grad school around people 10, 12, 13, 15 years younger than me. I can see similarities in people younger that reflect the observations that Strauss and Howe made about millennials as an archetype. If you believe in their ideas that history is cyclical and hero archetypes leave a certain footprint behind based upon who we intrinsically are, there are some things that have not been factored in yet that I want to try to tackle and see if they make sense to people. So that's some of it
Yeah,
I'm working
I'm
on.
curious about that. I've been fascinated by the older millennials for a long time now because every time I see something cool, I think, I know a millennial built that. They have something different that you don't see in other generations. And like on some level, they scare me a little bit because they're running the Biden administration right now. They're told that era, that gen, like Jen Psaki, you know, like that generation of millennials, they're so motivated. They're so smart. And yes, that overparenting helped give them that confidence that the boomers had from their parents, too. It's scary.
Well, I would actually say a lot of the people in the current administration who are the public, it's public faces. Actually, a lot of these people are Xers, not to
Yeah, no,
paint
I
a brush
love
on
my
you
gen.
guys.
I'm proud of my. I love my
Yeah.
generation. I think I
Yeah.
have the best generation.
But what I think is important about the generational conversation is it can very, very easily lead to people wanting to make generations the cause of everything that happens. And
Yeah,
you can
for
see it as a
sure.
lens through every single person. And of course, I'm sure there's people who know me well who are laughing right now listening to this because they go, "Oh God, you do that all the time."
It's
You know,
inevitable.
oh, it's
Kids
inevitable.
these days.
100%.
But one thing to remember is there's a before and an after. There's people, you're the last generation that remembers life before it became a double life of virtual and real. Because my daughter's generation grew up with a virtual world, right? So she's into fantasy role play and all this stuff that I had no. And when you're growing up like that, you have an avatar. So you have I, this is my me in my real life, and this is me online. People like me know, and you know real life, right? We remember it, but they don't. Nobody else coming after them is ever going to know what that is, what that means.
And I think to follow on that, and I completely agree, I can't absolutely vouch for this, but I do get the sense, just from things that I've observed, that we were the ones who I think made the cleanest break from Facebook. And it definitely has a lot to do with we were the ones who were in the whirlwind of when Facebook hit like a tornado.
Yes.
And just disrupted everybody's college life. I think I was a freshman when it started to hit some campuses near me. And my sophomore year in college, it was everywhere. It was like water. It was like air. And I can't absolutely confirm this, but the sort of the whole line, your mother or your grandmother's on Facebook.
No.
That's kind of become a put down line now for saying, move with the times. It's passé. I've heard a lot of people about my age say that, and I do think it has something to do with the fact that we were all living a certain way and relating to our peers a certain way, or thinking about relating to our peers and comparing ourselves to our peers a certain way in college when we were around that age to begin with. And Facebook just put that on steroids. And
It
at some point, we
really.
all had to get off and just say, "Nah, I'm done with this." And obviously,
Yeah.
Instagram's still a bigger thing. But Instagram is mostly seems to be mostly populated by people younger than me,
It
and that doesn't
is.
surprise me.
I asked my daughter, what's the social media app you use? And she's like, well, we mostly use Instagram to connect with each other. And so they do not. Poor Mark Zuckerberg, man, he must be freaking out about that because I actually left Facebook too when after my politics changed, because I spend a lot of time thinking about tribalism and what social media has done to us, because I came from one tribe and left it, and now I kind of exist on the outside and what that reminds me of. And it reminds me of 1984. You built this inside and there's this outside, and the inside is so weird. And people knew me a certain way. They knew me as a Hillary Clinton supporter. And when I said things like, you have to humanize Trump and his supporters, I'm doing that. I'm looking for the truth. I want the truth. Every single one of them attacked me and hated me and still hate me, won't talk to me now. And I just thought that's really weird that we built this machine like that, that can build this community that people can then be purged from. That wasn't what real life used to be like in
Yeah.
America,
And
you
it was so, I mean, I've got a lot of thoughts about Mark Zuckerberg. Not all of them are complimentary. What I
know?
will say about him is he's another one of those people around my age. He's about a year and a half older than I am, where when I started to get a sense of who he was, or at least who he presented himself to be and what his background was, I was like, oh, he's millennial to the nth power.
Totally. I do always identify people
Yeah.
by
And
generation now.
I can see one of the things that I've mentioned to people a number of times is that if you look at the people who were making the biggest, who were leaving the biggest imprint on music, fashion, sports, anything in a cultural domain in the 2000s, people born 1981, 1980, and earlier were the faces that drove a lot of the trends. They were the
Yes.
people selling most of the records. They were people selling out big concerts. And there's a very clear difference. There's only, I would say, two or three people born 1982 and later, who I've seen in a Wikipedia search when they were born and gone, huh, I thought they were an Xer and they're, you know, actually a millennial. There's a few of those people, but for the most part, you look at 82 and after, 81 before, it is a clear difference. And the impact they had and the pop culture presence they had in the 2000s is a big sign of where the
Absolutely.
difference lies.
But still, too, like I, you know, look at Taylor Swift, she's a total millennial
Oh, yeah.
and she's hugely popular in a way that most people aren't. You know what I mean? Like in a way that most musicians aren't now. They're not so ubiquitous. I mean, I guess you could say, you know, Katy Perry, but she's sort of the same age, but no, there's nothing like Taylor Swift. She's a worldwide phenomenon. And that's where you start to get into the millennials are the boomers when you look at stuff like that. And that's the new generation of politicians that's going to take over as soon as the old guard gets out of the way.
So I've been looking at this kind of stuff a long time. The one thing that I was actually having a conversation about this with someone the other day is, again, because of the way these conversations kind of go and people want things to be black and white before and after, there's always a tendency, and this is particularly true, I think, when millennials get talked about in the media, or now Gen Z, to say, well, now this one generation is either driving a particular trend or is moving into a different phase of their life. And so they're not as omnipresent in the popular culture. And that means this. When it's never a simple matter of, or I shouldn't say never, it's very seldom a simple matter of one generation is leaving something, another generation is arriving, and then it's only a matter of a few years before it's all one generation again. There's all kinds of different. So with respect to millennials and politics, we're still very small in number. Your generation, Generation X, is obviously, I think, conspicuously underrepresented in politics for your generation's age, but your numbers are going to grow. Your power and presence is already demonstrably greater than it was in the 2000s, kind of during the W. Bush period. I actually looked this up, that the peak all time of boomers' representation in the U.S. Congress in D.C., if you just go by elected seats, was the U.S. congressional elections of 2006. Oddly enough, 2 years before the first Gen X president was elected. So that there's a gradual. It's like the, you know, the ebbing of the tides or the changing of the tides. It's gradual. In terms of millennials rising to be the dominant generation in politics, and not just a few faces and names making a big commotion about things, that's probably at least 10 years away. And given who some of the prominent millennials in politics are now, it's probably a good thing.
Well, I feel very much like my generation was called to this moment. And I know that's very forth turning of me, but because we're cool. Like Gen X is cool because we're outsiders and we are outspoken and we're contrarian. And you know, we're not afraid to say what we think in general. That's not true for everybody, but Elon Musk is Gen X, right? He's a perfect typical Gen Xer, but he's not the only one, you know, that I feel like at a time like this, it's a necessary component to the weirdness of it, that the people that are willing to just stand in the breach and say things that other people will not, are not like buying Twitter was such a huge cultural shift that Elon Musk did. And I think that only a Gen Xer could have done that. Personally, but I could be too absolutist on that. But all right, so now we have to talk about the gray champion. I don't think you actually agree with me that Donald Trump is the gray champion, but that's my theory.
To be quite honest, I wanted to stay away from flatly declaring him that person because I knew a lot of, I'll just be honest, I knew a lot of my audience would go, oh, come on, he's not. They would just have that
Well,
instinctive
I can
gut
make an
reaction.
argument for it though.
Oh,
I can
absolutely,
make
100%. I even heard last year some people say to me or leave in comments on my videos, well, what about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.? And I gave what I thought were reasonable arguments at the time. I was just like, nah, I don't think so. I'm just going to give my mea culpa here and say I underestimated the impact he would make. And so I have been, if I produced that episode today, it would have a somewhat different flavor to it. Donald Trump, for a variety of reasons, whatever happens the rest of this crazy year or for the next 5 or 10 years, he's going to go down in history as somebody who fits that mold. And
One of,
one
right?
of,
One of.
and one, and one of the things that really, I was disappointed that Neil Howe hedged on who fits the criteria for a great champion in his new book. That's one of the things that he moved the goalposts on a little bit. And I wish he had simply said, look, great champions are prophet archetypes, and they're prophet archetypes for a reason.
They're made, not born.
They're made, not born. And he was trying to be more inclusive of who fits the definition. And I was just like,
Yeah, you know what happened to him, which I find so fascinating, is that he did a video where he t says Trump is a person who could be the great champion, but he always says could be, right? He never says is,
He doesn't
which
want to be
is
held to it.
fine. No, he has to hedge. But that was before January 6th. And after January 6th and that, I think he changed his mind about Trump, and he changed his mind about the future even. It shook him and rocked him so hard, which I understand. It did a lot of people. But I'm just saying that, in my opinion, the great champion of what everything I've read per Neil, the original text, not the New Testament, but the OG, was great champions are the one person that can emerge in history that breaks the whole thing and stops whatever is happening from happening. And only one person can do that. Not one, many, like Winston Churchill, FDR, Eisenhower, they were all great champions. It wasn't just one.
Eisenhower was actually younger. I would say
Oh, was he?
Douglas MacArthur fit that mold. He was
Oh.
a prophet. I think of all the people who I would have loved to see in a room with Trump, Douglas MacArthur
Oh
is
man,
on the
be so
short
great.
list. Two gigantic egos, but again, principled people who were just unbreakable.
And Churchill was, people don't want to, he was my hero, but people don't want to see him. I know this guy who just hates it when I say this, but I do see him as very Trump-like, because believe it or not, he was kind of hated back then. Certainly hated more than anybody else in government, but man, he was the one guy, the bulldog. Now, I'm not saying that what Trump is fighting for is as a noble of a cause as stopping Adolf Hitler. That's a one-off, but I think he's one of the great champions. I'm not saying he's the, but he's certainly one of, because he is willing to stand, because they're throwing everything they have at him, and he's still fighting with this grassroots movement against this crazy oligarchy that, now look, Neil Howe has a point, because if you look at Gen Z, they're the future. They are very much left leaning. They are very much collectivist minded, inclusive and woke, and they're not hung up on tradition. They're not somebody like me that wants movies to be the way they were in 1975, you know. They don't really think about that. They watch a movie on their phone, they'll watch TikTok. They don't care. They're not married to the idea that movies have to be in movie theaters. Like, they don't know anything about the kind of technology we had growing up. Everything is so easy for them. So why wouldn't they want a collectivist utopia? And the way I see it now is the only person who is stopping that is Trump, potentially. I was thinking of RFK Jr. too. And I do think that he is playing a role. He's one of the truth tellers who's standing up. But you know, if you think of the image of the great champion who comes up and stands there and just says, "Not through me," there's only one guy right now doing that.
Yeah, it is a great window into Strauss and Howe got so much right, and yet because it's a theory, it has to be continually tested and
Yeah,
proven.
right.
And the Trump phenomenon is, I think, the great champion is a concept that's helping people appreciate who Trump is and some other people like him are. They are who they are for a reason. And we're at this kind of crossroads as a country for a reason. The thing that I wish Neil Howe would acknowledge a little bit more, and as he continues to give interviews on the podcast circuit, I hope he starts to acknowledge that there are other forces and factors besides generational change that are leading us down a certain path to whatever comes next. And that's why the political correctness phenomenon is something that has really come to consume me, because it's what I see as the hallmark of almost all the powerful people who oppose Trump.
Yeah.
And that in and of itself is worth noting.
Yes, and it is a war of ideology that is between Obama's America and Trump's America. Now, this is how I define these two things. I don't define Trump's America as MAGA and their policies. I define Trump's America as an America where the empire has collapsed and we can get back to quote unquote normal and everybody can see each other as people again and we're not policed on everything we say and do. And we can make great movies again. We can write great books again. We can tell good stories again. We can share as a country. We're not polarized. That's my version. Obama's America is more like 1984. And I'm not saying that in a negative. I'm not saying it's a dystopia. I'm saying that in their vision, it's online, it's global, it's not confined to the United States. It's ideological, and we're ideologically aligned with Europe and Sweden or whatever else that, you know, goes along with us. And then you look at the other side would be to them the axis of evil would be the Trump world, Putin, China, everything that's non, you know, in agreement with their way. It's very much rooted in virtual spaces, and they've overtaken streaming. So all the streaming platforms lean left. Elon Musk is the only outlier there with Twitter and TikTok, which they can't control yet. But their utopia is right there. That's why they're fighting so hard for it. They want this to be the new normal for America going forward, where everybody is ranked by identity, and that's the new power hierarchy. And there's no such thing. It's exactly like 1984 minus the militarism, although we're even getting some of that now. But if you read 1984, you watch how they what they do with language, what they do with history, the way they have to control, and they even have children spies, which is like cancel culture. That's the world that the left wants to be going forward. And that's between Obama's America and Trump's America, in my opinion.
Yep, the Obama's America, what binds it together is transformation of America and the world away from bourgeois or traditional values, a clean break, and rule
Right.
by experts, rule by professionals,
Yeah.
rule by the politically correct. The
You
Trump
got it.
side is the opposite.
The last video that you made, I think, talks about. Well, no, there's one that you made. I don't know if it was the last one, but there's one you made about that, about the expert class, when you said that the media, you know, was kind of called out, and that they were so willing to embrace what these people were telling them, but they're corrupt. Their ideas are corrupt because they have only one conclusion. So basically, what they've done is they've just rebuilt for themselves what the boomers got away from the traditional religion. They've just built a new religion, basically, to fill themselves up and to make sense of our world. And I think personally, and I hope it's true, that if history is any indication, what we're having coming next is a counterculture revolution, which I'm very much looking for. And you, young man, are young enough and smart enough to be in that. And that is so exciting for you. I can't take advantage of it, but I feel the same sort of excitement that I felt when I got online in 2000, where you could make anything, you could build anything. The counterculture revolution will be that, and it will be the gulag on the outside of utopia that gets bigger and bigger and creates this thriving new world of culture that it's going to be fascinating to live through. And you're really lucky that you're about to live through it. I have very high hopes for you. You're going to write great books or whatever you want to do. Movies, documentaries.
That's hard to top. So I think we'll start to wind down then. Thank you for all that. On my more hopeful days, I have aspirations for exactly what you just for
You
exactly
go.
what you just said, and that people who genuinely are committed to the truth, whatever it is,
The truth. Thank
have the
you.
ability to
Yeah.
express it and have the ability to move among like-minded people and live the lives that they want, knowing that they're still accountable and responsible for their fate, but
Yeah.
they don't have to be part of the matrix,
Let me
as
just
it.
leave you with this, really. What I always tell my daughter is she says to me, I have this great book I want to write, but I can't write it because of A, B, C, and D, right? She knows that she'll get in trouble for this, she'll get in trouble for that. Nobody will put, and I said, you know what, Emma? Write it. Put it away because in about 10 years, it's going to be huge. Because here's the thing, all the interesting stories right now are happening on the left, but there's nobody to tell those stories. So in the 1960s, and you had Rod Serling with The Twilight Zone, you had Arthur Miller writing The Crucible. And that was like, it was incredibly creative time to be able to puncture the power. But now you have the artists are the powerful, so they can't write about it. But imagine what's happening with the Democrats right now with Joe Biden and that debate and Kamala Harris. How fascinating is that as a story, you know? But they will never write it. They'll never write all the kind of hypocrisy that we're seeing, the emperor's new clothes playing out every day. But in about 5 years, when all the smoke clears and the dust settles from our great war, then it's going to be wide open and you're going to be able to write that stuff. And so that's what gives me hope for the future.
May we be here to see
Yes.
it. Double
Oh,
cross of the fingers. Wow, such a great conversation. Thanks so much for coming on. And just to wind down here, do the appropriate thing. Where can people find you? How frequently should people check in with your work? And what should people know that you have coming up?
no. I write stories on sashastone.substack.com that are mostly political, probably point of view, MAGA, I would say, Trump, and that's sort of my interest because I do find it fascinating. But I also do every, you know, maybe once a week, I do a long form podcast, which people really like, but, you know, doesn't get a lot of engagement because they're pretty long. But so I do that. And then I also write about movies on awardsdaily.com, but that's mostly just Oscar stuff if you're interested. I'm quite outspoken on Twitter, where you can find me at Awards Daily or Real Sasha Stone, my private, which you have to ask for me to get you, which you're my friend on there. But so I have those two accounts on Twitter. That's where you can find me. So.
Great. Well, thanks so much. This has been another episode of the Generation Report. Thanks so much to everyone for tuning in. And thank you, Sasha Stone, for being my guest.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
All right. Thanks, everyone.